This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was the fall of 1982, and Pico Iyer was a young writer for Time magazine. He was on his way back from a business trip to Hong Kong, and he found himself in Japan on one of those really long layovers. Now, Iyer says this was a good time in his life. He certainly didn't feel like anything was missing. He worked in the bustle of Manhattan. He traveled around the world covering politics. It was, he said, a high-speed, stimulating, and interesting life. So he wasn't looking for anything or really expecting anything when he landed in Narita, Japan. It's about 40 miles from Tokyo.
There I was, stuck in an airport hotel near Narita Airport. And I woke up after a good night's sleep, and I still had 4 hours to kill. And I didn't really know what to do with them. And I happened to see a little sign in the lobby advertising a free shuttle bus into the town of Narita. And I thought, well, how interesting can an airport town be? I've been to Queens, I've been to Inglewood. They're not usually great places of beauty or fascination. But what else was I going to do? I probably would never be in Japan again, I thought. So I got into this little bus, and it rattled me for about 20 minutes through this big urban landscape, crowded streets, five-story buildings, concrete and glass. Then it dropped me off at a bridge. And I went across the bridge, and suddenly I was in this much more intimate area. Narrow lanes, wooden houses. Shoes laid out perfectly outside each house at the entrance. Flashes of the autumn gold and scarlet through the windows at the back. It was very quiet. Nobody else seemed to be there. I followed this riddle of lanes up to what turned out to be a 1,000-year-old temple. There was a big white pebble courtyard in front of it. I'd never seen a Buddhist temple before, so I just sat there for a little bit. Then I came out and I saw some gravestones, and I followed them around a corner to the temple garden. And in the temple garden, there were a group of kindergartners in blue and pink caps who were scattering around collecting autumn leaves. And somehow, as I stood there and looked at this late October day, which is very bright, but the first pinch of the coming cold, and I watched those kids, I thought to myself, I know this place. I know it better than the street I grew up on. I know it better than my apartment back in New York City. And if I don't come back here soon, I could easily end my life feeling that I'd never lived, so something unresolved that I have to investigate. By the time I boarded my plane, 3 hours later, I'd decided, on the basis of one morning in an airport town, to move to Japan. And it took me 3 years to extricate myself from my job, but finally I did, and I moved to Japan 32 years ago, and I would gladly spend every hour of my life there. And thinking back on it, I often think it's so strange that it happened during this unwanted layover in an airport town.
Pico Iyer, who joined us recently to talk about his life in Japan, where he lives with his Japanese wife and Japanese children. He still lives there on a tourist visa, though, and his grasp of the language isn't great. But he told us it's definitely home, though he's still not quite sure why.
I could explain it to you, but I wouldn't believe the explanation, because I think the nature of affinity is mysterious. The way sometimes you'll meet a stranger and you feel, oh, I know this person. I know her better than I know my own parents or my old-time friends. And that's how it is. I think we have those kind of magnetic affinities with places. So at some level, Japan is very similar to the England that I grew up in, but it's an England that will always be exotic and indecipherable. It's this wonderful mix of somewhere that feels very familiar, but somewhere that will always be foreign. And there are other ways in which I could tell you why I recognized it, as it were. But I think deep down, it was just an intuition that this place understands me. I'm on the same wavelength as it. And this is where I ought to be.
Mm. So 4 autumns later, as you put it in the book, after that experience, you moved to Kyoto, as you say, suitcase in hand, as you put it, outside the door of a tiny temple. And I wanted to ask you, why live there? And why live there in the way that you are? Because you haven't become Japanese in any way. You still dress like a Westerner. It doesn't sound like you eat much Japanese food. I mean, the way you've described it is living in a constant state of, I think this is how you've put it, disorientation.
Yes, or certainly delighted bewilderment, and which I love because I can't take anything for granted, and I'm always getting surprised, which is what I want, especially as a writer. But I think the places where we belong are not necessarily the places we're officially connected to. So if you were to look at me, you'd see my Indian face, but I've never lived in India. I'm not really at home there. And you probably hear England in my voice, and that I grew up in England for 21 years, but I don't know if that's really my home. And I've been officially resident in California for more than 50 years, but it will never really feel like home to me, though it's very welcoming. So you're absolutely right. I have no official connection with Japan, but it just feels like the home that was waiting for me. Now, to answer the first part of your question, the reason I chose a temple in Kyoto was I thought this would be the perfect complement to my accelerated life in Time magazine, 4 blocks away from Times Square. So there I had a lot of movement, and the news was constantly clattering up. I was working all night in the office amidst really fascinating colleagues. So I thought, well, I've enjoyed this high-paced urban life, and what I really need is a chance to reflect on it and to put it in perspective and to see how deep that happiness runs. Because I thought, I'm having a great time, but I could continue like this forever and suddenly wake up at the age of 70 and realize that I hadn't explored other avenues in life. And since I was in my late 20s and I didn't have any family responsibilities, I thought this is the time to try something radically different. And I knew that whatever happened while staying in a temple in Kyoto or walking down the street in Japan would be different from New York City and would probably open up different parts of myself. And it certainly was a good compliment. I mean, if you were to go to Kyoto today, you'd see this very busy city with lots of high-rises and a lot of traffic. But it was the capital in the 8th century of Japan, so it's still the home to all the traditional Japanese arts. And it's surrounded on 3 sides by hills, and in those hills are 1,600 temples and 17 World Heritage Sites. So it's a big city that could be mistaken in parts for New York, but it's encircled by temples from the 14th century or even from the 8th century. And I knew I was never going to find places like that in New York City.
But it's also interesting that that's not where you settled. I mean, you settled in a place you've described as the synthetic suburb of all of those places, where there aren't, in fact, temples and shrines, at least not nearby. Why there?
Very good question. So I lost my heart to Kyoto, and I lost my heart in Kyoto because my 3rd week there, I was actually at a temple ceremony, and I was seated next to a Japanese woman, and she became my wife. And so once we were together, she made the decision to move to this little suburb that's only 20 miles away from Kyoto, but in some ways is very different. Partly because being Japanese, she liked the comfort of a Western-style neighborhood with air conditioning and heating and, you know, much less high maintenance than a tatami mat room. But I think when I wrote a book about my first year in Kyoto when I was in the temple and in that exotic city. And then 30 years on, I've just written this new book that you were discussing, Autumn Light. partly because of my sense that it's always easy to fall in love, but the main challenge for most of us is how do we stay in love? It's not difficult at all if you arrive in Kyoto tomorrow to be transfixed by this exotic city with 1,600 temples and probably to fall in love with a person, as I did. But 31 years on, when you're living in a sort of mock Californian suburb with somebody you've known for 32 years and you're just spending all your time in this neighborhood, how do you keep the sense of excitement and discovery alive? And actually, Japan is as exciting to me now as it was when I first arrived, but in a different way. But I'm grateful to the suburb for telling me I'm not just in love with Japan because it's exotic and different from New York City. I'm in love with it for just everyday life there.
The book is a way of you and your wife processing the death of her father. And the way you've connected it to Japan, but also to autumn. How do you describe it, the book? It's a rumination, it's an essay, it's almost a memoir of sorts. How do you describe it?
Good question. I think it's a meditation on impermanence and how we find our joy even in the midst of a world in which death is the end of every sentence. How we deal with death and how we don't get defeated by it.
You were in Florida. Your wife calls to tell you that her father had died. And she says to you something I wanted to ask you about. It's interesting the way you portray the sort of clipped sentences that you share with your wife, which gives us an indication of, as you've said, you haven't entirely adopted the language, and it's part of what you like about it. But she says to you, after she tells you that her father had died, "Okay, now must make new life." What did she mean?
Well, I love the practicality and the groundedness of that. And so she was saying, I think when I moved to Japan from where my parents live in California, I thought I'm moving from a society that's based on the pursuit of happiness to a society that's based on that Buddhist notion of the reality of suffering, that every birth ends in death, every meeting ends in a separation. And I think the Japanese are very good at dealing with reality. So my wife, the minute she lost her father, of course she was grieving. Of course she would feel that loss, and she does to this day, 6 years later. But she said, this is the reality we have to deal with. My father's gone. My 86-year-old mother is alone. I have to do something with her now. And now I face the new circumstances of my life. Now life has dealt me a new hand, a new set of cards. This is what I have to work with. And of course, it's in some ways like what Japan did in World War II. They suffered this horrendous and humbling defeat at the hands of the US. And they didn't waste too much time about wishing things were otherwise. They instantly thought, well, let's learn from the US now. Let's remake ourselves. Let's start a new life and look towards the future, which we can change, instead of the past, which we can't change.
There's that practical way she's looking at the death of her father. But then there's that contrast that comes with the rites that are associated with that death and the fact that, as you've explained, she still boils water for her father's, I guess, tea and breakfast every morning still.
She does, which also is practical, because I think all of us, when we suffer a loss, we're at a loss. What do we do? How do we get out our sorrow, our anger, our confusion? And one of the things Japan is very good at is reducing life or exalting life into a set of rituals. So people know how to hit their marks and what to do, even in an emergency. So as soon as her father died, she knew exactly the protocol for cremating the body and conducting various funerals and when the Buddhist priest would come and visit. And she also, as you were saying, knows every day to this day, 6 years on, she will prepare her father's favorite kind of tea and his favorite snack and put them out on the household altar for him. And for her, and as for my Japanese neighbors, he never really left. It's almost death is like another room rather than another state. And so on her days free from her job, she literally will go to what in Japan is called a city of tomorrow, which is a graveyard, and she'll fill in her grandmother, who died in 1979, and her father, who died in 2013, on all the family news. She still talks to them. And in Japan, again, at certain points in the year, especially in midsummer, all the gravestones are encircled by lanterns so that the departed, it's believed, can come back and look in on their much misloved ones here on earth for 3 days, and then, thanks to the lanterns, find their way back into their home in the heavens. And I think a lot of traditional societies have this. I think Mexico in the Day of the Dead has some of the same. Just this sense that we're still in communication with the people who are no longer breathing. They're still living inside us. And there's no reason to assume that they're gone forever or that we needn't still talk to them or, in this case, even make tea for them.
Pico Iyer, his latest book is Autumn Light, Season of Fire and Farewells. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream, enjoy podcasts like Radio West and Preach, browse local news, and access our 24/7 streams of BBC World Service and classical music. You can also use the new Station Finder tool to locate the KUER radio frequency that's closest to you. And if you have CarPlay in your vehicle, our app is now compatible. The KUER mobile app is available for iPhone and Android wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the writer and journalist Pico Iyer about his connection to Japan and how the fall, the turning leaves, the diminished light, reveals this attitude of people there. They cherish things precisely because they cannot last. And Iyer doesn't see this as morbid or even sad. He sees in it hope and appreciation. His latest book is Autumn Light, Season of Fire and Farewells. Why do you go to Japan in autumn?
I go to Japan in the autumn because the skies are brilliantly blue, absolutely cloudless, warmer than Southern California into the early days of December. But right under that blue are all the scarlets and golds and lemon yellows of the turning leaves. And they sometimes say in Japan that life is about joyful participation in a world of sorrow. And I feel the blend of that joy and the sorrow and the way they're almost part of the same thing, I think, more keenly in the autumn than anywhere. And of course, I know you've got a lovely autumn in Utah, and I used to live in New England, which has this radiant fall. But there's something about the mix of wistfulness and buoyancy in the Japanese fall that really gets to me.
You say that the mix of those colors, this is the place's secret heart, you say.
Exactly. I think Japan lives in the blend of radiance and melancholy, and in that knowledge that beauty and sadness are inextricable, that actually happiness and sadness are inextricable. If we're really happy right now, we know it's not going to last forever. And so too with sadness. And I think of Japan as a very wise elder that realizes that everything is passing. And I think when I first went there, everywhere in the world experiences impermanence. But in Japan, they're much more aware of it. And I think they realize that the fact that things don't last, the fact that winter's on its way, is actually not a source of sorrow, but of joy. It's a reminder that to enjoy this moment. I'm sitting here in California in late October. I don't know what is going to happen tomorrow. I can't take anything for granted. So let me make the most of this conversation I'm having on what's actually quite a beautiful blue-skied day. So they have this keen sense of mortality, but I wouldn't say that's all about sadness.
Yeah. Well, it came to me when you were writing about hearing these elementary school kids singing this song that, as you say in the book, it sounded like the hymns you used to sing maybe in school in England. And in some ways you say this could be the scripture of Japan. That's how you put it. this children's song, which is about the limits of destiny and how important change is. I just found that so striking that this is being sung by children.
Yes, exactly. So that's beautifully said. And then when I think back on the hymns I used to sing in school, they were mostly about affirmation and light and hope and our home in the heavens. And as you say, in Japan, it takes a very different quality. In fact, if you're walking around the ancient capital of Kyoto, there's a bell that tolls all the time. And my wife will tell me the bell is reminding us your time is limited. Make the most of it. If you walk to a graveyard in Kyoto, there's a big white sign, thoughtfully translated into English, with a motto that says, today you may be feasting, tomorrow you may be a bunch of bones. And of course, that all sounds very morbid, but the effect there is not at all morbid. And I think those children who are being reminded of limitation at a very early age, in some ways are also being reminded of possibility and freedom in a different way.
Hmm. You have described your life in Japan, living your life as a foreigner. I think you've described it as playing this part in a national pantomime where
yes.
You're a foreigner and just be content to stay a foreigner, Pico. You don't have to be one of us. It seems like that idea of making a distinction between those inside and outside the community is important for the Japanese?
Very, very important. And so, yes, my friends are sometimes surprised to hear that I've lived in Japan for 32 years on a tourist visa. And,
right.
Of course, I could get a spousal visa because I'm married to a Japanese. I could even actually get a job and get a work visa. But I feel like a tourist. And as you said, I don't want to kid myself. I don't want to pretend I will ever be Japanese, because I won't. And I don't want to alarm my neighbors. And I almost want to reassure them, don't worry, I'm not intruding on you. I don't pretend or claim to be part of your community. I'm just a really interested guest who wants to learn from you. But if you're not having a good time with me, I'll be happy to go away. And so I want to honor those divisions, which, as you say, are very important to my Japanese neighbors.
You've talked about how in Japan the unsaid thing is part of the official language. Explain what you mean, that part of the thing you're trying to convey that is left unspoken, I guess.
Yes, and I think that's a universal. I think every couple or every family knows that it's often what's between the lines that is really more important than the words that are said. Mm. But in Japan, that's especially pronounced because I think people are comfortable using as few words as possible, even in sort of trivial contexts. Let's say if you go into a sushi bar in Kyoto and you order a steak, the waiter will say chotto, which means a little. He'll only say a little. Really what he's saying is it's a little crazy, you're a little silly to ask for a steak in a sushi restaurant, and it's a little impossible. But he'll never say no, or he'll never say anything confrontational or rude. He'll just say a little, and you fill in the gaps. And after I was in Japan for a little while, I noticed that the ideal date in Japan is two people go together, watch a movie, sit there in rapt silence for 2 hours, and then go home, but never discuss the movie. Because words pull us apart. Words are what we use to divide one another, and silence is what brings us together into a kind of communion. And in Japan, that notion of communion or harmony is very important. And I think they know that words can be used as smokescreens or as weapons or as diversions. And since everything is about harmony, they're very happy almost for as many people as possible to use the same words in the same cadences and not disrupt that order.
Do you think this is the essence of haiku in some way? Paring it down, post-verbal, non-verbal, not direct. Do you think that's the essence of maybe some of their poetry or the way of writing like that?
Exactly. You couldn't have put it better. Yes. And of course, most haiku don't use the word I at all. They just register an external scene, a group of plovers flying across a lake in an autumn twilight. And yet you feel so much emotion, and it's so personal, even though the word I is never mentioned. And precisely the fact they're only using 17 syllables actually fills you up more than if you described that scene over 17 pages. So exactly how in a haiku, most of what you see on the page is empty space, and that's an invitation for you to come in. You're not being lectured at. You're being invited to share that feeling. And of course, in a Japanese painting, it's often just brush and ink, and most of it is empty or negative space again. And that's a way into the painting, as opposed to being confronted with a very complicated, jam-packed canvas. So yes, I think all Japanese art is about suggestion rather than the statement, because suggestion is like a dialogue, whereas statement is like a monologue.
I've heard you described going to Japan as an attempt to try to learn to, I think you've put it this way, speak silence. And I'm wondering if that's something you can do. And does it stay with you, or when you leave, does it wear off, if you know what I mean?
Yes. I think more than anything, I went to Japan to learn to listen. Because I do feel that Japanese are great masters of attention. And it's almost startling to us when we go to Japan and we meet somebody for the first time. All her attention is on drawing you out, on making you feel comfortable, on asking you what kind of tea you prefer or where you would like to sit. None of it is about her imposing her particular wishes or preferences on us. It's a very responsive culture in that way. And I thought, well, I've grown up in England and the US, and I've been taught to speak to some extent. I need to learn to listen more. And I'm hesitant to say that I've learned very much over my years there, but I think I'm quieter, I hope, and I use fewer words than I did when I arrived in Japan. And for example, the two books that I just brought out are very short, as you've seen, and I spent 16 years essentially taking everything out. I was working from maybe 8,000 pages of notes and 32 years of my life and my exchanges and encounters and emotions. And what I did for 16 years was take more and more out, just as in the haiku that you were describing, so that the spaces between the words would be charged, and that the reader, I hope, would feel everything that wasn't being said. So that's something I, as a writer, have probably learned to do during my many years in Japan. I wanted to keep things out of these books for two other reasons, which are appropriate to their topic. One is, since the first book ends with my father-in-law's death, I was trying to address that sense we all know about how absence can fill us up more than presence. If you've lost someone in your life through a death or through a breakup, you know that you're completely possessed by that person much more than the people around you, that you're aware of the person who's not there even more than of the people who are in the room around you. And also, as you were saying, just this sense that silence can be more eloquent than any words. I know if somebody is sick, or especially if they're on their deathbed, they don't necessarily need words. They don't need lectures or texts. They need somebody to sit next to them and maybe to hold their hand. But I think silence is a much greater gift to them in that kind of situation than more words.
One of the things you've said is the way Japanese people speak, and you've mentioned their voice modulation, like their cadence. Their cadence having the intended effect of making themselves invisible. And as a Westerner who likes this idea of being an individual, who likes this idea of people trying to assert themselves or fight for their rights or engage in a community, I didn't know what to make of that. How do you – surely you as a Westerner responded – In a similar kind of way, the people playing roles, settling into roles, making themselves invisible. How do you deal with that? How do you think about that?
So well said. And it must be said also, we were earlier talking about how the Westerner plays a part in the pantomime. Yeah. As a Westerner there, your role is to break all the rules, to be blundering, to be too loud, to be rough. So luckily it comes naturally to some of us. Yeah. But I think beyond that, I did feel, I've been trained quite intensely in individuality, in being visible, in making sentences, maybe it's not a bad thing to learn the opposite. And of course, I will never be Japanese. And of course, my Japanese friends long for that sense of engagement and possibility and individuality that they associate rightly with the West. They want to learn individuality from us, just as some of us want to learn to be more invisible from them. But insofar as I went there feeling, being a writer and cranking out words for Time magazine is a form of visibility, I've done that. I need to explore other avenues in my life. I went there seeking out that kind of quality. And of course, as soon as I got there, as I say, I met my wife. And women, unfortunately, are still given very little scope for movement in the public sphere in Japan. So as soon as she saw me, she was reminded of all the things she couldn't get in Japan and all the many ways in which coming to America would allow her to be an individual, would allow her to have scope in the public domain, would allow her to craft her destiny and make a future for herself, which she didn't feel in Japan. So I think those of us who live in a very free culture, as we do in the US, sometimes need to learn about the benefits of confinement or restraint, as in going to Japan. And people from a culture like that are longing for the chance to explore freedom that we have over here. So I think it can ideally be a nice mutual exchange.
So you moved to Japan to learn how to, as you put it in the book, best dissolve a sense of self within something larger. But how does that fit with ping pong? Because this was a surprise to me, and how you found ping pong, how you became lost in ping pong, and the connection you make with these friends playing ping pong, how does that fit in this story?
I'm so happy you mention it, because this book is partly about autumn and solemn things, but at its heart, it's also about ping pong, which is a very fun thing. And I think it brings together all the themes we've been talking about. One of them is, although I live on a tourist visa, in the ping pong club, of which I've been a member for 15 years, I'm the only foreigner in a group of about 30 Japanese. And so it taught me how to fit in to a Japanese group. So the first thing I learned was to try really hard with every point, but never to want to win. It's a curious thing that my Japanese friends keep score of every point in a game, but they don't keep a tally of who's winning the games. We change partners every 5 minutes by lot. So if you do happen to lose, you'll soon have a new partner. You'll probably win the next time. We play best of two sets. So often there are no losers at all. And it's the same thing that happens in a Japanese baseball game, in a Japanese professional baseball game. If the score is tied after 12 innings, it ends in a tie. And sometimes a team with a lot of ties finishes ahead of a team with more victories. So again, that's anathema to us here, where there's always a winner and loser. But in Japan, they don't necessarily want anyone to win or lose. And I realized after a few years in the ping pong club that one very nice aspect of this was that every day when I come back home after playing ping pong, I never say to my wife, I won or I lost today. She can just see I've had a great time. And everybody leaves in an equal state of delight because we've all enjoyed the games. We've probably won a few and we've lost a few. But because we're not keeping track of that, all we're aware of is that we're part of a group in which everybody is enjoying himself. And the other thing that's interesting about the ping pong club, which speaks to some of what you were asking me about, is, of course, my communication with my friends is very limited because my Japanese isn't so good. And with one exception, they don't really speak English. But I feel I know them better than I knew my colleagues in Time magazine, because playing a game like ping pong with somebody three times a week for 15 years, I know just who, when the score is 5-5, she's going to say it's 6-4. Or if there's a table free, I know just the one who'll race out to grab the table and just the one who'll very graciously step back so others can play. And I feel they know me very well. They know me better than my friends in California might. And it's an interesting, so they know nothing about where did I go to school, what's my job, which country did I grow up in, but they know the essentials of, is this guy competitive? Is he going to be kind? Is he going to miscalculate the score deliberately every time? And I feel that I really have a sense of kinship and closeness and friendship with my friends there, even though we don't know much about the superficial details of one another's lives.
And you only play doubles, which is interesting.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, this is how you write it in the book. You said that that it was like each player was, and here's the quote, treating each other as part of themselves, as in a dance or an act of love.
Exactly. And I think in that same paragraph, I say that really their wish is to play with each other rather than against each other. So
right.
I almost think of Japan functioning like a symphony orchestra. Every person knows her part. And by playing her part perfectly, they make this wonderful sound. But exactly right about the doubles. I was a little surprised at first when I went there, and I'd be rallying with somebody and I'd wait for the game to begin, and they would subtly point out that we couldn't begin a game until two more people showed up and we could play doubles. And because we're changing partners in doubles again, you lose all sense of who's on top. And it hits me more because I do have an English arch rival here in California with whom I play ping pong when I come back. And when I play singles with my old friend, I notice that if I win a game, I'm actually not so happy because I know there's only one way to go. But that's down. And I keep on thinking, oh, he's going to seek out revenge the next time. And of course, if I lose a game, I'm still thinking, oh, how did I miss that forehand slam in the third set? And so whether I win or I lose in singles against my English friend, I can't sleep at night and I'm always rattled. Whereas in Japan, I don't know if I've won or lost. I just know I've had a marvelous time. Mm.
The book is so much about impermanence, as you said before, and you write this in the book, that autumn poses the question we all have to live with, how to hold on to the things we love, though we know that we and they are dying. Say more about that, if you would. That what? It's about seeing the world as it is, yet still finding the beauty in it and the truth in it still.
Yes, that you put it so well. I mean, always keeping in your mind reality and possibility. There's a wonderful poem by the Irish poet Seamus Heaney. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison in the 1990s, Seamus Heaney said something like, "Once in such a long time, hope and history can rhyme." And I think for a lot of us, our lives are about mixing hope and history. History reminds us of all we've suffered and that life has its difficulties and challenges and limits, but we need to keep hope alive. And in the context of death and the sentence that you just read, I think there's this sense that, so I'm in my early 60s now, as is my wife. Who knows how long we're going to be here? So let's make the most of each moment. Let's not postpone things. And let's actually cherish the fact that that we're in a kind of autumn and be reminded that autumn has certain strengths and wisdoms that spring might envy. So one of the things I like about the ping pong club, many of my friends there are in their late 70s or even in their early 80s. And every now and then a teenager will show up and visit the club for a day. And one of my friends who's 83 years old will thrash the teenager. And I think, oh, well, this is wonderful. This man, by virtue of being 83, is actually stronger physically as well as maybe philosophically than an 18-year-old. That the world doesn't just go in one direction. And sometimes I've found, and I point out in my book, that we're wiser when we're 25 than we are when we're 65, but in other ways we're sometimes stronger when we're 65 than 25. And autumn, you know, during the Japanese autumn, they won't talk about Indian summer, but on a beautiful day they'll sometimes say it's a baby spring day or it's a second spring day. And so again, as with happiness and sadness, they're not opposed in Japan. Autumn has spring inside it. Not the case that spring has autumn in it, but autumn has the memory of spring, the memory of summer, and every autumn is bringing us one day closer to the next spring. So things are not clear-cut and binary the way we sometimes believe. And I think I didn't realize when I was young, but I realize much more now, life always has surprises in store for us and makes better plans for us than we would make ourselves. And so autumn is not necessarily a sad season, and we all know that spring is not always only about happiness.
You said something that made me realize or made me think, this is why he's so connected to Japan. This is why Japan seemed so familiar to him when he first encountered it. And you said this. You said, all my writing is about trying to put realism and hope into the same sentence. So there's the same thing there, right? Realism and hope together. And that's the essence of what you're talking about in Japan. So maybe that's why you feel so at home there.
Yes, precisely. And for example, there's a moment in towards the end of my book, Autumn Light, in which I describe the Dalai Lama coming to Kyoto. And he comes to Japan every year. And every year, my wife and I travel with him every minute of his working day across Japan. And I realized, I put that moment in there. So I travel up with the Dalai Lama to a fishing village that has been devastated by the tsunami. And I often think, I've known the Dalai Lama for 45 years, and I often think he's probably suffered more than anybody I have met. And he's had the most difficult life, carrying single-handedly a whole culture on his shoulders, living in exile, seeing so many people around him fall away. And yet, we all know, and I know he's been to Utah many times, that things that the Dalai Lama are famous for are his infectious laugh, his constant smile, his robust confidence. And many years ago, I wrote a book about the Dalai Lama, which is exactly about how, in the face of reality, and he's a super realist and has to be as a leader of his people, one can still find hope. And so you're absolutely right. I think addressing the Japanese autumn, which is about the reality of autumn and that the hope that comes with these bright blue days, is very much the same question I was addressing when I wrote about the Dalai Lama. If you live without hope, I think life is really painful and there's not much to redeem it. And if you live without reality, you're living in a false universe up in the clouds, and life is going to be sending you wake-up calls pretty violently. So all of us are trying to find that balance in our lives. And I found the Dalai Lama does a very good job of it, and he's somebody from whom I would want to learn. And in a different way, I find my Japanese neighbors who've been living for 1,400 years now with warfare and earthquake and forest fire and tsunami. And yet, if you walk around the streets of Japan, everyone is bright and positive and accentuating the positive. They, too, have given me a way to address this conundrum, which I think is at the heart of many of our lives.
We've also talked about how the way he balances science and faith. For him, science comes first. Science trumps faith, you say, for the Dalai Lama.
Exactly. So if you go to his house in northern India in Dharamsala, right across the courtyard from his house is a temple. And there are only two sentences up in the temple. And one of them is a quote from the Buddha, which says, if empirical study or research or analysis or science shows my words are wrong, please throw out my words. And the Dalai Lama is always stressing that. And for example, he'll point at old Tibetan texts in which it's believed that the moon and sun were equidistant from the earth. He says, throw those out. Those are useless. They're based on a false vision of reality. Old maps he doesn't have time for. And I think of the Dalai Lama as a doctor of the mind. And as with any physician, he has to deal with the condition, not with the way things we would like them, how we would like things to be, but he has to deal with the way things are. And for example, to his Tibetan people who are now often in exile in southern India, he will say, get rid of your Tibetan clothes. Those are perfect if you're living at 15,000 feet in Arctic conditions, but in tropical South India, they're the worst possible things. So it doesn't matter if you get rid of your clothes, if you adapt to this new reality, as long as the fundamental values and priorities you hold don't change. But he's very, very practical, which again, as I said earlier about my wife's response to death, is something that I really appreciate in some of those older cultures.
Talk about what he says to your wife, Hiroko, when she goes and lives there in Tibet for, I don't know if she does this every year, but she was visiting him and talking about her father. What was the advice that he gave her? How did he respond to the news that her father had died?
Yes. So there are two moments in the book I mentioned. I think, so as you say, she used to go and live just across the street from the Dalai Lama in northern India for 7 years. And at one point she saw him and she said, Your Holiness, my parents are getting quite old and, you know, I'm worried. What's the best thing to do? And he said, go back, look after them. Don't come and see me. Don't, you know, spend time around the doctor. Deal with deal with the reality of the parents and spend as much time with them as you can. And after that, she stopped going and spending springs across his house, across from his house. His advice was so direct and so practical, she knew exactly what to do. And in the book Autumn Light, I also describe a moment when we're traveling with him, and just as we're about to take our leave of him, she says, "Oh, excuse me, Your Holiness, I just want to tell you, my father passed away." And the Dalai Lama asks, you know, when did he pass away? What was the cause? And then he just holds her for a long, long time, very warmly. And then he steps back and he says, remember, only the body is gone. Only the cover is gone. The spirit is still there, which is exactly what the Japanese believe anyway. But just very simple, practical reminder that in some ways her father is still living inside her and inside her brother and other people. And indeed, like many people who have lost a parent, for many months after she lost her father, my wife would feel her father walking and talking through her. In some ways, she was closer to him than ever before. So, as always, he gave just the very succinct but useful advice.
You write in the book about how you despair of ever being able to convey the bounty of your life in Japan to your friends in the West. They're always asking you questions, which I'm sure you get all the time. Are you bored? Are you lonely? And it comes back to this question of how it is that Kyoto could be home for you. Because it seems like, and this is something you referred to earlier, but like, isn't home the place where you're first rooted? Isn't it the place where your people are from, where you feel some, you know, deep-seated, almost kind of biological connection? I mean, some feel it in desert places, you know, in the south part of Utah I'm thinking about. Some people feel it in high mountains. Some feel it in coasts. So, I don't know. It just seems to me that how can that place be home for you when you weren't necessarily from there? But it is your home. At least that's how you see it now.
Yeah, I think home is the place where you become yourself. And I think a lot of older cultures will say we have two homes in our lives. The first, where we happen to be born, where our people are from, where we spent our childhood. And the second, as you were saying, in those places that move us. And my sense is that many people, such as myself, maybe from Britain or Germany, come to Utah and feel, wow, this is the place that really makes sense to me. This chimes with me in a way that Wiltshire or Frankfurt never did. And you might feel the same going to parts of England or Germany or Japan. And I think home is not necessarily the place where you live, but it's what lives inside you. Mm. And when I came to Japan, we have a very simple life. We live in a two-room rented apartment as if we were students still. We have no car and no bicycle. I think I was confessing to you before that I have no cell phone because I feel I've got enough data and distraction in my life. What I really want is the time and space to make sense of it and remember what's important and follow what I really care about. And so in all those ways, Japan is a very rich place for me. And I remember as a kid reading in the works of many old wise souls, the Stoics and others, they say that richness is not a matter of having a lot of things, but being able to do without a lot of things. Contentment is really about all the things you can afford to live without.
Well, it won't be long when you're back in Japan, and autumn is seeping into your spirit, as you explain it in the book. I guess you must be looking forward to that experience of starting to disappear, as you describe it. Your sentences starting to grow slower. Do you gear up for a kind of a physiological change in some way?
I'm very excited. Tomorrow, I'm actually going to Japan, and I've only got to spend 1 week in the last 10 months. There. So I really have been gearing up for all these 10 months for my return. And as you said, I'm going back just in time to catch the autumn. I'm not sure there's any physiological change. It's more an emotional or a psychological change, actually a real sense of freedom because I'm in the place I love, because I know I will have time to take walks every day, to play ping pong, to sit out on the terrace and read a book, which is the best form of conversation possible, that I'll never feel hurried. My days will not be cut up and I won't feel that I'm running from thing to thing or that I'm scattered. I will feel in some ways as much as I can be that I'll be collected by being in one place and even when the weather is not so good, probably in a relatively content state of mind. So I'm cherishing the expectation the way one would cherish a drive taking you up to the top of a mountain where it's spring all the time, even in autumn.
Pico Iyer, he's a writer and a TED Talk speaker. His new book is Autumn Light, Season of Fire and Farewells. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we want to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Thanks to our intern, Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.